Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by John Murphy, who's serving as our worship associate, our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus, our music director, Hal Walker, and the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent choir. May the flame we now kindle, the light of our chalice, wake up our spirits, illuminate our minds, and open our hearts to this moment. For now is all we have been given.
The first two Unitarian Universalist principles state, we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. This past week, we celebrated the words of Dr. Martin Luther King as he spoke on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial 50 years ago. As we reflect on Dr. King's dream, we should also remember the critical role that labor unions played in the civil rights movement. The labor movement was made up of diverse groups of people whose purpose was to fight the injustices of the industrial age and to raise every person out of poverty, provide a safe working environment, guarantee job security, make medical care equally accessible to all women, men, and children, and to reward years of labor with a livable wage that wouldn't force workers to live on the streets, in homeless shelters or flop houses, or worse, left for dead. As I searched through various sources to prepare for this morning's call to worship, I was reminded that it was E.D. Nixon and the Pullman Porters who provided the young Dr. King with the resources to make the Montgomery bus boycott successful, and that trade unions led by A. Philip Randolph were the initial organizers of the March on Washington in 1963. I myself am a proud member of the Crestwood Education Association. To me, being a union member is about much more than money. It is about the job security that keeps my family safe. It is about being part of a larger family of people, not just in my workplace, but in this state, on this nation, and on this earth. If you have ever been a part of organized labor, or if you have ever been affiliated with organized labor through family or other relationship, I ask that you please rise if you are willing and able, and call out in just one or two words what being a union member means to you. Thank you. Strong is what we make each other. Come, let us worship together.
This morning we begin our religious education program for the church year. So in essence, today is the first day of school. And I found this really lovely reading to share with you, and it's by that prolific author, Anonymous. If you write upon paper, a careless hand may destroy it. If you write upon parchment, the dust of centuries may gather over it. If you write upon marble, the moss may cover it and the elements erase it. If you carve your thoughts with a pen of iron upon a granite cliff, in the slow revolving years, it shall wear away, and when the earth melts, your writings will perish. Write then on the heart of a child. There engrave your thoughts, and they shall endure when the world shall pass away, and the stars shall fall, and time will be no more. For that heart is immortal, and your words written there shall live all through eternity. The individuals that we are honoring this morning are men and women who understand in a profound way that there is no they to be responsible for the spiritual nurture of children and youth. We are taking time to dedicate them to their extraordinary task of helping to raise the next generation of Unitarian Universalists. And we thank them this morning for their commitment to this church, to Unitarian Universalism, and especially to our children and youth. And we have asked them to accept this great responsibility, helping our children and youth grow and develop within this community. And we wish them to know that we acknowledge the responsibility they've accepted and respect the commitments that they have made. And so now I will read the names of each of our teachers and leaders who are working with our children and youth this year. And teachers, as I say your name, please stand and remain standing through our litany. Our preschool teachers are Mary Leeson, Amanda Rome, Lisa Slater, and Joe Fatchett. Kindergarten, first, and second grade teachers are Sandy Eaglin, Joe Kemmerly, Tanya Call, and Isabel Farnsworth. Our third, fourth, and fifth grade teachers are Cheryl Spur, Andrew Rome, Teresa Vanita, and Shayna Steinhaus. Our school age group that meets at the 11:30 service, it will be led by Jennifer Gregg, Vivian Sandland, Lois Weir, and Tim Smith. Our middle school teachers are Rhonda Richardson, Liz Bright, Bobby Beal, and Dan Flippo. Our high school youth group leaders are Marianne Casper, Lori McGee, Beth Kemmerly, and Kathy Kearns. And our whole lives teachers for grades 4 to 6 are Jennifer May and Jeff Lang. So please join me in dedicating their work with the litany that is printed in your order of service. And there's a part for everyone, including the children and youth. And it's in your order of service. We begin with the adults. We are grateful for your willingness to build strong relationships within this community, an example of your living, and for encouraging the spiritual growth of our children and youth. Children, we thank you
for your willingness to teach us through the respect you show us. We will learn as much from who you are as from what you know.
Teachers, all of us. Each of us plays an important role in our church. We welcome the gifts we bring each other as we grow and are inspired by our time together. Thank you, teachers and leaders.
This Labor Day weekend, I'd like to invite you to join together in a meditation on the labor of our hands. So if you're holding things, you might put them down and hold your hands before you. We are all laborers, every single one of us. And each of us has labor that we do with our hands. So I invite you to take a moment to look at your hands and really see them. Notice the shape, the color of your skin, the lines from age, the scars, the spots. Notice how your hands look and honor them for the work they do. And now notice how your hands feel, rubbing them softly together. Are they smooth or rough, wrinkled or calloused? Notice how the way your hands feel tells you something about the work of your hands. And honor the work of your hands. Our hands do the work of our lives. And so I invite you a moment silently to name for yourself the work of your lives that you do with your hands. Blessed be the work of our hands. And with our hands, we also engage the loves of our lives. The work that we do that is not burden, but sheer blessing. And so I invite you to name for yourselves the ways in which you show love with your hands. We honor the work of our hands. All of us are laborers. So look to your left and look to your right and notice the hands of the people near you. Know that those hands have held a lifetime. Know that those hands have done tasks humble and exalted. Know that those hands too have clenched in anger, opened in peace, and helped shape the work of this world. We are all laborers, and every single one of us labors with our hands. And so this morning, we give thanks for the power in our hands. We give thanks for the love we show with our hands. May all of our hands be blessed in the work that we do in this world. Spirit of life and of love, Spirit of mystery and wonder, we gather this morning as people determined to live our lives well. We have fear in our hearts as we hear whispers again of war. We pray for our leaders who must determine the way forward. We pray that it may be peaceful. And in our own lives, may we commit again to walking the path of peace. We begin with ourselves and our own hearts, making peace in ourselves, which often requires finding time to quiet, to slow down, to still, and remember what is most important. May we walk the ways of peace with our families and our friends, making repairs when we lose our way, forget how to quell the arguments, lose our tempers. Let us make peace in our families and with our friends. And with our neighbors and in our communities, let us practice the ways of peace, modeling with our lives that peace is always possible. And as we make these efforts, calling ourselves back to the path of peace, may we remember that no matter what is going on in our personal lives, no matter what is happening in the world around us, walking in the way of peace is never a walk that we take in vain. May it be so, and amen.
Would like to make a special welcome this morning to our new accompanist, who is Vanessa, and she's here with her family. Vanessa Vesley and her husband Blaine are here, so we'd like to welcome them. We're so glad to have her input.
Our reading this morning comes from Buddhist scripture. The Buddha delivered this teaching to a man named Sigala, the son of a very devout parents who was himself indifferent to religion. Upon his death, Sigala's father asked him to engage in a particular worship ritual every morning in hopes that one day the monks or the Buddha himself might see him practicing and decide to offer him a teaching. One morning, the Buddha's attention did come upon Sigala, and he decided that he would give him a teaching on the layman's code of discipline. The discourse focuses on the social ethics of a householder, on the ways that an ordinary person should conduct their social affairs so as to behave ethically. This passage speaks about how employees and employers should relate to one another. Living wage from the Sigalovada Sutta. In five ways should an employer respect workers and servants. One, by allocating work according to their aptitude. Two, by providing them with wages and food. Three, by looking after them when they are sick. Four, by sharing special treats with them. And five, by giving them reasonable time off work. So respected workers and servants reciprocate with compassion in five ways. One, by being willing to start early and finish late when necessary. Two, by taking only what their employer gives them. Three, by doing their work well. And four, by promoting their employer's good reputation.
As it is for many people, my first job was babysitting. My second job was filing in the dentist office of one of the people that I babysat for. My third job, but the one I considered my first real job, was at a grocery store. Shortly after I started high school, I was hired as a bagger. I ended up working at that grocery store for 6 years, throughout high school and the first 2 years of college. One of the things that happened to me when I got that job was that I was told I would need to join the union. That grocery store was unionized, and it was a closed shop, which meant that everybody who worked for the store had to be a part of the union, whether they wanted to or not. I, being 14 years old, didn't know anything about unions, so I did what I was supposed to do, paid my union dues, and didn't think very much about it. Looking back in retrospect, I can see the advantages that I had because I worked at a unionized grocery store. I received a fair wage. I had regular wage increases that I didn't need to ask for. They were collectively bargained for me by the union. I had access to benefits, including paid vacation time as a teenager at a grocery store. I had sick days. And I had access to a fair and transparent promotions policy, which I took advantage of. By the time I stopped working at the grocery store, at the end of my sophomore year in college, I had become a manager. All of these opportunities were available to me, in large part, I realize now, because I worked for a unionized store. Since then, I've had a lot of jobs, some great and some truly awful. I can honestly say, though, that the best job I have ever had is the one that I hold here at this church. It's satisfying not only because I love this work to which I have been called, but also because you are a fair, respectful, and responsible employer. And I bet you don't think about that very much, the fact that you are an employer. If you're a member of this congregation, you are an employer. You delegate the work of being an employer to the folks on the personnel committee and the board of trustees and to various members of the staff who supervise positions in the church. But the responsibility and the oversight of being an employer is ultimately held by the members of this congregation. And I want you to know, in case you don't, that you are a good employer. My experience in the workforce enables me to appreciate the wisdom in the teaching of the Buddha, especially what the Sigalavoda Sutta says, that employers should respect their employees in concrete and meaningful ways and contribute to their employees' well-being, and that employees should in turn reciprocate with diligence and loyalty to their employers. Our nation has struggled mightily to realize such an ethic. The history of labor in our country teaches us that though there are always employers who strive to do the right thing by their workers, there are likewise always employers who are more motivated by profit than they are by any internal sense of right or wrong, or even by established labor laws. Workers have suffered terrible abuses, including unsanitary and unsafe working conditions, excessively long hours, inadequate pay, wage theft, and sexual and racial harassment in the workplace, among other hostilities. And so all of us are indebted to the labor organizers of previous generations who risked so much in the struggle to ensure respect for workers' rights. There are so many powerful and important stories in the history of labor organizing, so many key victories and crushing losses. I'll share just two with you. The first one, nearby from Akron, in the mid-1930s. The employees at the Firestone rubber plant already received low wages and already were concerned about being unable to meet their basic expenses, not able to pay their rent, not able to buy food for their families, when they were informed by management that they were going to receive another pay cut. Strikes had been happening all across the country, and so the workers at the Firestone plant decided that they would strike. But they actually innovated a new tactic in striking. They called it a sit-down strike. And instead of striking outside of the employer, which is what people across the country were doing, they sat down at the workplace, which had the advantage of keeping them together so that they could communicate, kept them out of the elements, and also prevented strikebreakers from coming and doing their jobs. At the end of the first day of the strike, all of the employees in plant number one were sitting down on the job. At the end of the second day, all of the employees in plant number two were sitting down at the job. And at the end of the second day, management conceded not to go forward with a proposed wage cut. Inspired by their success, the employees at Goodyear decided to go on strike 10 days later. It took them a little bit longer, took them about a month, but at the end of the month, 10,000 employees working for Goodyear in Akron were on strike, sitting down at the job using that same tactic, and eventually management conceded there too. Those strikes at Firestone and Goodyear, as I said, were part of a wave of strikes that were happening all across the country in the mid-1930s. Workers were getting increasingly organized, and unions were gaining in strength and in influence. They wanted standards to which employers could be held accountable. President Roosevelt was in sympathy with the demands of the workers and wanted to give them protection, so he passed what was called the National Industrial Recovery Act as part of his New Deal legislation. In addition to ensuring fair trade codes, the NRA, as it was called at the time, set forth a minimum wage, a 40-hour maximum work week, and protections against child labor. But 2 years after it passed, a case came before the Supreme Court, which involved a provision of this act, and the Supreme Court ended up striking down the whole thing. So they were back to the drawing board. Roosevelt was determined to try again for labor reform, and so he made labor reform a part of his reelection campaign and won in 1936 by a landslide. He interpreted that victory as a mandate to enact this labor reform that he had been campaigning on, and so he devoted much of his next term to winning labor reform along with his Secretary of Labor, Perkins, Francis Perkins. He put so much political leverage into that effort, and finally, after much struggle, as we can well imagine, and back and forth between Congress and debates and concessions and amendments, they finally, in 1938, passed the Fair Labor Standards Act. And thanks to that effort of organized labor and dedicated politicians, all of us can count on a national minimum wage, a 40-hour work week, and protections against child labor. Workers today benefit from the gains of those who have come before us. And still, the work is not done. There are many employees today who still abuse their employees in the workplace. Part of the problem comes from the weakening of unions, in my estimation. Though the union star rose for a time after all of those victories in the middle of the early part of the 20th century, the power and influence of unions began to fade, and it's faded even more in recent decades. We read in the news of workers who would like to unionize but who are prevented from doing so by anti-union employers. Of course, most people might think of Walmart first, but the fast food industry is another important example. Workers in the fast food industry have the inglorious distinction of being the lowest paid workers in the United States today, lower even than farm workers. By any measure, working at a fast food place does not provide a person with a living wage. This was brought to widespread attention recently when Stephen Colbert did a piece on the McDonald's new budgeting tool for workers called Practical Money Skills. This tool was created in partnership with Visa, and you can go look it up yourself. It's on the McDonald's website. It's supposed to show McDonald's workers how to budget their money so that they can cover all of their expenses. On the sample budget that you can find on the McDonald's website, they base spending on the assumption that the worker has two full-time jobs, McDonald's and another one. Even given that assumption, the budget allocates only $20 a month for health insurance and nothing for heat. After they received well-deserved ridicule for that oversight, McDonald's changed the sample budget currently on their website, which, if you go look at it now, allocates $50 a month for heat. However, it's still just $20 a month for health insurance, and they leave gas, groceries, prescriptions, and childcare costs to be covered by the $750 of monthly spending money that's left after all of the other necessary expenses are covered. Around here, full-time childcare costs for one child are more than half of that total, and that's at low-cost childcare. And remember, this budget assumes two full-time jobs. Because fast food workers are not paid a living wage, many end up qualifying for public benefits. What that essentially means is that other workers, taxpayers, are supplementing the income of fast food workers because their employers do not make them pay them enough to make ends meet. That's why fast food workers in more than 50 cities across the country went on strike this past week. For the past year, they've been involved in a campaign fighting for a living wage of $15 an hour and the right to organize. Their campaign is supported by the Service Workers International Union. They're not unionized, but that union is providing support for them to enact this strike. And there was coverage this past Thursday of strikes, coordinated strikes, all across the country. Though much of the public is supportive of the efforts of the fast food workers, there are still lots of people who think of fast food as an entry-level job for teenagers and therefore think that the low wages really aren't all that bad. But in truth, over 70% of the people who work in fast food are adults for whom their wages are the ways that they provide support for themselves and their families. The Unitarian Universalist Association chooses a book every year for what's called a common read. Everybody, all the congregations are invited to read the book together. The book this year is called Behind the Kitchen Door by Saru Jayaraman. In her work, she explains that there's a hierarchy within the restaurant industry. Fast food workers are at the bottom, workers at family restaurants are in the middle, and those who work in fine dining are at the top. But lest that word top be misleading, it's important to know that 7 of the 10 lowest paying jobs in the United States are in the restaurant industry. Fast food workers are at the bottom, and the other 6 in that lowest 10 include dishwashers, coffee shop and cafeteria workers, hosts and hostesses, and dining room and bartender helpers. Just because someone works in fine dining is no guarantee that they make a living wage. Much of it depends on the job that they hold in that restaurant. Though the full-time wait staff and executive chefs at very high-end restaurants do well, 80% of the workers in the restaurant industry don't make a living wage. One of the biggest reasons for this problem is that wait staff and bussers are subject to what's called the minimum wage for tip workers, which is currently just $2.13 an hour. According to federal law, if a worker doesn't make enough in tips to earn the higher federal minimum wage of $7.25, the employer is supposed to make up the difference. But the sad truth is that many employers don't do that, and workers have very little recourse. In her book, Jayaraman tells stories of workers whose employers engaged in wage theft, and they do this in a variety of ways. They withhold tips left on credit cards, tell workers to report tips that they didn't make, require that workers pay a percentage of tips to the employers, and then so often require them to clock out before they do their side work, their cleaning shifts at the end of the night. Another major problem in the restaurant industry is the lack of sick days. According to research conducted by the Restaurants Opportunity Center, 90% of restaurant workers don't have paid sick days. Consequently, over 2/3 of employees surveyed report that they have indeed come to work to prepare, cook, and serve food while they were sick. This isn't just bad for workers. This is bad for everybody who eats out at restaurants. In one very high-profile case 2 summers ago, over 3,000 people who ate at an Olive Garden had to be vaccinated against hepatitis by city health officials because an employee came who was exposed to hepatitis came to work because he didn't have any sick time and didn't feel that he could afford to take the day off. The third major problem she reports in her book is another hierarchy within the restaurant industry. This one has to do with the racial and gender stratification of workers. In general, the highest paid positions in the industry are reserved for white men. Women still experience a glass ceiling when it comes to executive chef positions and the highest tip potential dinner shifts in upscale restaurants. Though women make up 72% of the wait staff nationwide, they tend to work in casual rather than in fine dining, where the earning potential is higher. And people of color experience barriers to advancement based on skin color, with the lightest-skinned employees working in the front of the house and the darker-skinned employees working in the back of the house, especially in the lowest-paid dishwashing positions. Jayaraman is clear that she tells these stories of inequity and injustice for restaurant workers not to depress us, but to empower us. You see, we're a nation of people who like to go out to eat. A stunning 75% of us go out to eat at least once a week somewhere, whether it be fast food at lunch or to have breakfast or dinner somewhere. 75% of the people in the United States go out to eat at least once a week. And most of us make going out to eat part of all of our special occasions. In fact, this is one of the reasons that many restaurant workers report enjoying their work. They like people, and they like to see people enjoying themselves. This was certainly true for me when I waited tables. I waited tables in a lot of different establishments, but my favorite one was actually at a kind of upscale restaurant where people came mostly for special occasions. And it was always immediately evident to me that someone was coming for a birthday or an anniversary or to propose or something else. And it was an honor to me to be able to help make that evening special for them. And a lot of people who work in the restaurant industry feel similarly. So what can we do? Jeremiah says that one of the most effective and important actions that we can take is to speak with management about what we notice when we go out to eat. Reading her book and knowing what to look out for when we go out to eat is one good step. An even easier step involves taking a look at the Restaurant Opportunity Center's National Diner's Guide to Ethical Eating. You can look at this up online. To create this guide, they asked restaurants to share information about the wages that they offer, whether or not they offer paid sick days, and their advancement policies. And they've organized this into a really simple table where you can just look down. Mostly chains are covered, though some independent, I mean, they've only started this a few years ago, so mostly it's chains, but there are some independent restaurants as well. So you can just look at the restaurant and look over in just a glance, see what their employment practices are. So by having this information ahead of time, you can know what to look out for when you go out to eat. And then at the back of the guide, they have these photocopyable tip cards, which basically you can leave for the manager saying, I care about how the workers in your restaurant are treated, and I encourage you to check out this dining guide and see how you can improve your score there. It's a very simple step that we can take, but it's a step that can make a big difference. Unitarian Universalists are committed to the pursuit of justice and equity in our relationships. We have a long history of supporting a wide variety of justice efforts. In fact, William Ellery Channing, one of the first national leaders of the emerging Unitarian Association in this country, was an outspoken supporter of the Working Men's Association, which was a precursor to today's labor unions. Channing argued that all people were created in God's image and that all people had the potential to grow in likeness to God. However, he also recognized that working people experienced oppression and exploitation, which hindered their capacities for growth. The Working Men's Associations were designed to lift up low-wage workers and encourage them in their efforts to grow intellectually, morally, emotionally, socially, and spiritually. The form of the struggle today is different, but the work carries on. We're all children of this universe, and every worker deserves to be respected and fairly compensated for their work. By educating ourselves and choosing to speak up about what we learn, we can stand in union with restaurant workers in their struggles. Seeing ourselves as connected in those ways is one important way that we make each other strong. Seeing ourselves as connected and acting on those connections is one important way that we demonstrate that we truly are interdependent. We're all part of the web, so let's make it strong for one another. Amen, and blessed be. We have gathered in dedication to the proposition that beneath all of our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth, and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.